Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Mr. Beacon podcast. This week, we are going to be talking to Julie McGill, who is a vice president of supply chain strategy and insights at FoodLogic, which is part of Trustwell. So we'll be talking about the food chain. We'll be talking about traceability and food safety. And we've spent quite a lot of time on that, but for good reason. As technologists, no one buys our technology just for the sake of it. We have to find markets that are driving adoption. And this is a market that has a lot of drivers for new technology. Focus is essential for solution designers and entrepreneurs and businesses of all stripes. So we believe that this is a really interesting area to look at. And let's face it, we all eat food and we want to know where the food is coming from. And on this week's podcast, you'll learn a bit about what's going on behind the curtain. We'll be touching on the use cases, the technology, the standards, a few of the controversies. And Julie McGill happens to be a great conversationalist, and she has some hidden parts to her past that you might never guess. So stay for the second part of that to hear a bit more about that. But before we move on to that interview, I just want to say a few words about a sad subject. This show is all about IoT. We're a podcast, but I'm a podcast enthusiast, not just as a producer of a podcast, but I listen to a bunch. And one of the staples of my diet for many years has been Stacey Higginbotham and Kevin Toefel's Internet of Things podcast. Stacey on IoT. She's a great writer. She's an ex-analyst. The chemistry between the two of them is amazing. And so I was very sad to hear that it's the end of their podcast. So I do recommend that people delve into that. There's a lot of back episodes that have some very insightful interviews and observations and some great conversations. And I heard this news when I was cycling home from the office. And then when I heard Stacey talk about her recommendations of other podcasts that you could listen to, and she mentioned this one as potentially a recipient of the baton from people that listened to their podcast, I was really, really touched. I was quite emotional. I actually almost fell off my bike. So if you are listening or watching this podcast as a result of that, a recommendation, thank you for giving us a try. And thank you so much to Stacey and Kevin for producing an amazing body of work. And I am deeply touched that you recommended people to this podcast. So let's get back to business. Let's get back to Julie McGill. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. We really lift up the covers and look at what's happening in this rapidly moving driver for the adoption of IoT, which is food safety, food quality, food traceability. Enjoy it.
The Mr. Beacon Ambient IoT podcast is sponsored by Wiliot, bringing intelligence to every single thing.
Julie, welcome to the Mr. Beacon podcast.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about. We're going to be peeling the proverbial proverbial onion or unpacking the Russian doll, choose your metaphor. I want to talk about food with you. We all eat. So it's relevant to absolutely everyone, even if you stumbled on the podcast. But the business of food is fascinating, and it takes a lot of technology, software, auto ID technology, IoT technology, and Food Logic, which is the company you work for, which is part of Trustwell, which is the outer part of the onion, just to get back to my metaphor, is dealing with a bunch of interesting companies, some giants, Chipotle and McDonald's and Tyson and so forth. And the use cases are quite varied. So let's get into it. And how do you explain to people who Trustwell are?
Yes. So Trustwell, you know, our company is all about food safety and compliance for both the food and supplements industries. And so in the fall of 2022, Esha Research, which has the Genesis platform, which is nutrition facts panels, allergens, ingredient statements, we became, you know, we came together to form Trustwell. And so, you know, we have the recipe and the facts panel, et cetera, coming together with Food Logic, which is supplier management. So all the documents, audits, assessments, everything that we need, you know, all that paperwork to do business, right? Prove to me that you are who you say you are. If this is fair trade organic coffee, right? I've got to give you all that documentation and provenance to back it up. Food Logic also has incident management. So as things are moving through the supply chain, back of my store, I open up a box of tomatoes and they're moldy, right? I can open up the app, kick off an incident, and you know, get that item replaced, report the problem, and things like that. The next part of the Food Logic platform, we have a recall management tool. And so we all know recalls, right? Time is of the essence. And so using phone, email, and text, companies can build templates because, you know, class one, we got to get things off the shelf right away, right? Class Maybe. Two, class three, and it, for any of them, we need to get things off the shelf, but you need to notify teams, give them instructions on how to, you know, do I destroy it? Is the distributor going to come pick this up? You know, what do I do with this item, et cetera? And so the tool has a whole set of templates and communication protocols, but then it has a dashboard that collects all the information. And, you know, with most things with the FDA, you have to show your work. So you can, you know, print a report that shows here's everywhere that I, you know, who I contacted, what I sent, the all the actions that were taken. And the neat thing is it has, you know, different parts of the dashboard have things like a heat map that shows, okay, I've sent out the message. And then as the clock is ticking, things are turning yellow and red, and you're understanding, hey, why isn't this group, you know, taking action? And you can do escalation procedures and all sorts of cool things. But the piece that I knew Food Logic, when I came to Food Logic, what I knew them for was traceability. And that really was the origin of Food Logic. When mad cow disease was happening up in Canada, the founders of Food Logic created some tools to track all of the head of cattle. And so from that first, you know, product that they created, they said, wait, we could use this for tracking food across all foods in the supply chain. And so that traceability platform is where I really intersected with Food Logic, because I was working at GS1 at the time. And the standards that the Food Logic traceability platform is built on are GS1 standards. So things like global trade item numbers, global location numbers, critical tracking events, and things like that. So the Food Logic traceability platform can track foods, you know, literally from farm to plate, capturing all those critical tracking events, connecting the dots, if you will, right, of all of that disparate event data, using things like lot numbers, those global identifiers, and things like that, so that companies have full visibility of their supply chains and are able to, you know, utilize that data not only for compliance, for things like trading partner traceability programs, for federal regulations like FISMA 204, but also using that data in your own four walls, right? You have better visibility to your inventory, freshness, even product satisfaction, right? So it's interesting bringing these two companies together here at Trustwell. We really complement one another, right? This was not two similar tools coming together. It was two very important parts of the supply chain operations coming together to form one company.
Yes, and I think this is interesting because again, we all eat food and we want to find out what's in it, and we also want it to be safe. But you know, this podcast comes; its roots are in auto ID technology, IoT technology. And that's great. It's really important to understand that technology. But on its own, no one's going to buy it unless there's an application. And I've become very interested in food because it's driven by so many important drivers for adoption of the technology. And so we should probably get into how what you're doing is driving the kind of auto ID technology that we tend to focus on.
Yes.
But I think without companies like Foodlogic, that it's very difficult to sell an RFID tag, a Bluetooth tag, a barcode, a printing machine just in the abstract. You need powerful applications that have got budget and adoption that are really unlocking value. And you create and unlock value and you know, can harness budgets to be spent on the kind of cool techie stuff that a lot of us on that side of the house like to sell. So so many things I want to ask you about, but maybe we should start off with adoption of the kind of platform that you sell and how pervasive is it? You know, what are the alternatives to someone saying, look, we're going to do this properly, we're going to buy a platform, and just cobbling something together with a few, I don't know what people do if they don't buy Foodlogic or something that is in that category. Do you have a problem with people saying, we don't really need to automate this? You know, hopefully the FDA won't ask too many difficult questions and we'll never get a recall. Is that a problem?
Right. Well, and I will say, like, traceability drivers over the past, I would say probably the past 15, 20 years have been varied, right? Many of the traceability programs either came out of an outbreak, right? So the produce industry in the early 2000s had a number of outbreaks that the FDA and other parties, they could not figure out the source of the problem. And so entire categories were decimated. So spinach would be a good example, right? Yeah. Spinach outbreaks back in like 2006. They've never recovered. They've never gotten back to their same numbers. Part of it was, because they couldn't identify, which products, if you remember, everything came off the shelves, everything. Companies who had nothing to do with the issue, right? Their products were pulled off, along with everyone else's. So you think about things that we now focus on today, sustainability, waste management, and things like that. Not having the visibility forced, this just cleaning of the shelves, but also hurt an entire industry. And so, I like to joke that, spinach hasn't recovered because kale jumped in and said, hey, I'm good for you too. Now, people can argue kale versus spinach, but
big kale, it's a formidable entity.
And it's a bit rougher than spinach. I'll say that too, right? Big picture, that industry took action and created something called the Produce Traceability Initiative, which was focused on product identification and lot level traceability. And the reason for that is because the produce, companies said, we can't go through that again, right? If I'm a tomato guy or a lettuce guy, et cetera, companies can go out of business overnight if something like that just takes away their entire harvest. And so they recognized they needed to take action. So they came together as an industry, created the Produce Traceability Initiative. Other drivers have been things like trading partners, right? So we've seen trading partners like the Chipotles and Chick-fil-A's and CKE and others who said, well ahead of government regulation for traceability, I want to have whole chain traceability in my supply chain. And we also see that in grocery, right? Like both, you know, in the food industry. So those drivers, right, they've brought their trading partners to the table saying, here's what I need you to do and why. And for some produce, they're like, oh, I'm already doing that. Great. What, you know, let me do that. But other categories, you know, perhaps the meat had some pretty good traceability programs in place. But, say the mustard or the buns or whatever, some of those other categories, the French fries might not have been as aware of, hey, why do I need this? Right. And their partners had to educate them as to why they needed them to be a part of this program. And for many, they made it a mandate. So I was contractually obligated to do this to be your supplier.
Do you find adoption of your platform is being driven upstream or downstream? Is it being driven by the customer-facing businesses or by the producers?
Yep. Great question. So before FSMA 204 was finalized, most, not all, but most were the end of the chain. And they were saying, I want to have, you know, full visibility of my supply chain. I want to understand where my products are and, you know, be able to manage traceability and things like that. Inventory, they can use it for inventory management and other things. But there were some partners who were doing it at the beginning of the chain. And now with FSMA 204, we're seeing more and more customers coming in from across the chain, right? Because Now I have a regulatory mandate where I have to collect enhanced traceability records. I have to do this enhanced traceability record keeping, and I'm trying to figure out how am I going to capture this data? Where am I going to store it? And for many companies, their data sits in lots of different systems. So they want to bring it all together so they have one version of the truth, right? Here's all those records, and then be able to run reports for compliance, be able to extract that data. And for FSMA 204, that's within 24 hours, right? So, in our platform, you can put in, you know, whether it's I'm looking for cucumbers and here's the date range and maybe I even have the lot code, I can literally pull that data in seconds, right? And so that, you know, that driver now is where we're seeing more adoption across the chain. Before it was kind of, like I said, more focused at the end of the chain because partners were demanding data from their suppliers.
And we've had a couple of episodes where we've focused on FSMA 204, but and Frank Yanis most recently, arguably the architect of the rule from the FDA, was just on. But, you know, I think his perspective would be from the designing, the rule, you see the implementing of the rule because it's your tools that are being used to manage all that data. One of the things that really surprised me as a relative newbie to this area is that supermarkets, at least my understanding is, they tended to sort of have a assumptive model about what's going where. I just assumed that they knew everything about where everything was all of the time. And it really seems like they don't. They may know what gets shipped from their distribution center, theoretically at least. But the kind of the record of what's actually in the store is, at least for some very large ones, then is kind of assumptive. You know, we assume if we shipped it, it arrived. And, you know, my understanding is that's not adequate for FSMA 204. Is that correct?
Right. So to date, most companies were tracking, here's what I need, right? And so I need a case of this, I need, you know, a jar of that, et cetera. And that's true both for restaurants and for grocery. Now with FSMA 204, it's not just the item, it's I need the lot, you know, the lot information for each of those items. So if I get three boxes of lettuce, there might be three different lots, right? Or two different lots, maybe two of the boxes, you know, are lot A and one box is lot Z. And so that piece is the big differentiator, because when you think about tracking products at lot level, if I have a truckload of product and I understand what's on each and every pallet, I can do that with paper and I can do that with electronic forms today, right? Pallet number one is lot A. Pallet number two is maybe a mixed lot A and B. Mm-hmm. Da, da, da. I can track that very easily. But once I cut the shrink wrap and boxes are going to the store or to the restaurant, that is the point where you have to figure, companies have to figure out, how am I going to capture that data? And that could be through, some companies are arguing, well, I can do that using the information from my slot. Well, usually slots in a warehouse have two pallets in them. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes those two pallets have different lots. And when you replenish, I have a couple boxes left over from a third pallet that are now in that slot. So I can give you a ballpark, right? It could be A, B, or C, and maybe there's a D because there was a mixed pallet in there. But I can't be precise, right? Because I don't know exactly what the selector chose. If I use line of sight scanning, or if I use RFID, or if I use even some of the vision tools, those can tell me, hey, I saw you pull this box, or you told me you pulled this box, right?
Right.
And so that's where some of the issues come into play for what you just described, right? I know approximately what went to the store, but I don't know for sure. And we've even run into that, for example, a lot of companies that were early adopters of tech-enabled traceability. If you scan an order selection, that's great. You're in the warehouse. I scan the boxes, and these are the order that's going to store number 123. But while I'm on the truck, I walk into the store, or maybe the store before I get to you, I realize they're completely out of tomatoes. They didn't order any tomatoes, so I'm going to pull one of the boxes from your order and give it to this store.
Mm-hmm.
I know I deliver tomatoes, but if I don't do any sort of tracking, I have no idea which box of tomatoes went to store one and which boxes of tomatoes, right? I knew what was headed to store number two, but one of those boxes never made it, right? So depending on if you do at order selection or at point of delivery, right? Point of delivery says, I'm standing in front of the back door. These are the boxes that went in the door. Right.
Yes.
That's different.
So that's why we have critical tracking events, as to use the FSMA tour for vernacular. We have critical tracking events where you need to ideally be scanning or capturing in some reliable way, accurate way, what's shipped, but also what's received. And do you have a sense of what proportion of food retailers, restaurants, grocery stores, are scanning everything that comes in the back door today, which is presumably what they're going to have to do for when the rule goes starts being enforced in January 2026?
So I don't have numbers on that, but I can say from experience that whenever possible, we integrate with inventory management systems. So if your teams have a handheld of some sort, right?
Yes.
We will integrate with that, because that act of capturing the order as it's, you know, coming in the door, you're doing inventory management, and you just keep on doing that, but also send us that data, because that's a traceability event. That's a receiving event. Now, there are challenges with that, a lot of, for example, a lot of restaurants have night drops. And so the driver comes, he unlocks the back door, I put some boxes into the ambient area. Some go in the fridge and some go in the freezer. You know, those may or may not have been scanned coming in, or, you know, when the staff gets there in the morning and receives those items. Because sometimes the drivers actually put product on the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
Some leave it in the middle of the cooler, and then the person who comes in makes sure that the order was correct. So depending on what agreements you have with your distributors, you may or may not be able to collect that data with line of sight scanning, but I could capture it with some sort of RFID scanning, right?
Right. Yes. So that's very interesting. Let's just wind it back a little bit, because I feel like we didn't do your company justice in explaining the level of the breadth of customers you have. How many customers does Trustwell have? How many customers does FoodLogic have?
You know, I have to apologize because I don't know the exact number, and I should have looked that up for you. But you know, it's what I will say is it's a very impressive number of just the breadth of companies, especially, you know, I'm the genesis side of our product. It's everyone from academia and dietitians to large QSRs, grocery stores, CPG companies, and everyone in between. Because when you think of labeling, there's not only product labeling, but there's also menu labeling requirements, right? And there are some regulations that are in place that say, you know, restaurants have to do XYZ and have this menu labeling available. But they also need that information for their websites, right? And so the tools on that side of our business calculate all that information. And so piece of our business, I'm not 100% sure, you know, what the numbers are, but there was quite a bit of overlap of folks who were Genesis users that also were a FoodLogic customer. And so that was a nice, you know, compliment, like I said, because these two platforms address different parts of your business operations.
Very good. Well, according to your website, as I look at it, then there's 120,000 plus locations that are covered. Obviously, that's, you know, many more locations than restaurants, but it's quite a few customers anyway, many hundreds. So you have some pretty good visibility. What would you say the readiness is of the industry for FSMA? All done and dusted? Just putting a few dots on the I's and crosses on the T's?
Or? What I will say from personal experience, and this was true even pre-FSMA 204, there are certain categories that I had mentioned earlier that had business reasons to adopt enhanced barcodes and other data, you know, AIDC technologies. Mm-hmm. So the produce industry, produce traceability initiative, every time I walk into a warehouse, whether it be for a grocer or a broadliner, et cetera, when we walk down the produce aisle, 85% of those boxes are already marked with the GS1128. And so I'm so happy to see this because I used to work for GS1 and we use GS1128. We can accept GS1128 here at FoodLogic. So I'm so excited to see them. And then my first question is, do you gather lot information? Do you use those dates to manage freshness? Do you scan these codes? And most folks say, nope.
Yeah.
Where they do scan, this is one of the other categories that's been using it for a long time. Proteins and seafood have been using GS1128s for a very long time. One of the business reasons for that, beyond lot information, et cetera, is that a lot of those products are catch weight. So I sell my box of steaks by weight. I sell the tuna, you know, that whole tuna by weight, and that's how I get paid, right? So I need to have that information on the box. So that when I deliver that box to you, you understand box A was, you know, $150 and box B was $200. And the reason why, because of the weight, right? So proteins and produce have been using it for a long time. For FSMA 204, where we've got a lot of education to do, are the nut butters, shell eggs, ready-to-eat salads. Some of these categories that just, they haven't had an event or a driver bringing them to traceability. The other thing I will say is that there's a number of scenarios that we're going to have to figure out how to address. So a real easy example is fresh herbs are on the list. There are very few restaurants that get a whole case of cilantro, for example. Usually fresh herbs come in these great big boxes. You open it up and there are bags inside that have sleeves, six sleeves of cilantro, or it'll have two inner packs, right? So you order by the inner pack, not by the case. And so in my experience, I have seen some herbs that the bags have a 128 label on them. They certainly could have another data carrier, right? If the partner chose to use that. And there, I've also seen where you open up the box and none of the bags are marked, right? There's nothing on there. So distributors are going to have to figure out, how do I gather lot level information for those break case items? Because break case is a reality in our supply chains. How am I going to capture this data? So that's
going to there's a lot of work to do to label, to marshal the data in order to label. And then there's the question of, what's my automatic identify carrier that I'm going to use? Am I going to use a 1D barcode? Am I going to use RFID? Am I going to use ambient IoT? And each of those has different pros and cons. But I'm kind of interested, and it all costs money. You know, even a barcode costs money because you need to organize yourself around printing it, and it's, you know, people costs to scan them. Whereas some of the other ones, there may be more infrastructure costs, but less people costs. So it's all money. So the question in my mind is, where does the money come from to do what is at the heart of what you do, which in my mind is supply chain visibility? One of the things that you, your company enables is visibility of the supply chain. And it can be used for all sorts of things. You already enumerated a bunch of them. But I'm looking at a lot of the food safety organizations, and I'm guessing they don't have millions and millions of dollars of budget for this. I could be wrong. And so I'm interested in what your view is, working for a company that sells software. Presumably you like being paid for that software. Who is it that is funding these traceability projects, and how does that get unlocked? How do you get people to say, well, it's the right thing to do?
Right. So what I will say to that first is that, you know, for most companies, this can't just be a food safety or a traceability initiative. That's just right out of the gate, right? Mm-hmm. They have to address other problems. Usually operations is a group that, you know, keep it simple, please streamline, you know, our processes. Oh, and by the way, I'm resource constrained, right? So whatever you can do to make our operations easier, more accurate, right? They are willing to, you know, explore those options. Oftentimes, you know, we see a whole host of folks coming in because the IT team wants to know what's going on. And they usually have influence. They might not be the one writing the check. But yeah, operations usually is a very, you know, they may be the ones that are the final decision maker, but they are relying on input from all these other teams, because food safety needs it for this purpose, logistics needs it for this, warehousing needs it for this, et cetera. And those could all be part of one business, right? And so that piece is very interesting. And I will say, from a food logic standpoint, I like to say that we are data carrier agnostic. So I will take whatever you choose. And so GS1128 has been prevalently used. That's where most folks are, you know, able to scan today. But
that's a barcode standard.
That's just a standard barcode. We call that a 1D. But lots of folks are interested in using 2D, and we do have some folks using 2D. So that'd be like a data matrix or a QR code that can hold 2,300 characters. That's a whole lot more. The 128 can only hold 48 characters. It's not a lot of information. Then we get into, we do have some customers at FoodLogic who use RFID. And so it's frictionless. You know, we're using radio frequency. So no more line of sight, no more staff members standing over a box that won't scan. We are, you know, either using stanchions that are, you know, at the dock door or at the back of the restaurant, and or supplemented with things like a wand, et cetera. So even though you might have a staff member that has to go into the cooler and do inventory, it's literally taking seconds. You know, if we do the evolution clipboard, okay, they're going to be in there. They're going to get cold before they leave the freezer. You know, line of sight scanning, again, they're going to be in there for a while. RFID, you know, totally different ballgame. So it's been interesting for us because we've had to do a lot of education with solution providers to make sure they understand here are the components that we need to create those critical tracking events in order to do whole chain traceability. Once you get that piece in place, regardless of what data carrier they're using, then it's a matter of, okay, how are you going to then implement that across your supply chain? So like with RFID, we've had to educate our customers who are so excited about this technology, and it's a great technology, but I've had to explain to them, you can't just get rid of that 128 label and go straight to RFID, because there's always going to be someone in the supply chain who doesn't have RFID yet, right?
Yes.
So you need to have the label so that a human can read it, scan it, et cetera. And then for those who have RFID capabilities, the readers can pick up the information. And that's been a learning curve for a lot of companies who thought, oh, I can get rid of the old and go straight to the new. And it's like, they actually need to live together for a while, right? As the industry starts to adopt these new technologies.
Well, that gets me on to another topic, which is the exchange of data between the different players in that supply chain. And you know, whilst, you know, there's FSMA doesn't require you, the retailer, to know absolutely everything about where the food came from. You do need a source lot ID, right? But we're facing more and more need, it seems to me at least, for there to be more exchange of data between suppliers and distributors and retailers than ever before. And how is that, or A, is that true? Do you agree?
Yeah, I agree, yes.
How are people approaching it?
So for the foundational piece, you know, FSMA 204, I like to break it down into three buckets, right? There's product data, there's location data, and there's the events, right? The critical track events. So that foundational piece, right? The product and location data, that doesn't change very much, right? I mean, it does from time to time, but that's foundational data that trading partners need to be synchronizing. We talked about the GDSN, right? Synchronizing that data, sharing that information ahead of time. And most partners and supply chains today have some sort of supplier portal, supplier management, right? We have those tools here at FoodLogic where you're gathering all that information, right? Tell me about this product. Tell me about these locations. The event data is dynamic, right? It's ever changing. You know, it's order to order, it's product to product, et cetera. So, you know, that information, capturing it and sharing it. Today, we do a lot of that today with orders, right? I'm sending you a truckload of my lettuce to the distribution center. Here's the advanced ship. You know, you sent me a purchase order. I'm sending you an advanced ship notice. You know, there's at the door, there's going to be an inspection and they're going to check the load and make sure it's what you say it is. And they're going to run their temperature checks and all sorts of things. So today we gather a whole bunch of data about these transactions. But that last piece of, you know, traceability lot code and the lot code source, which is a new piece of information that we have to capture, there are some additional pieces of data that folks just were not capturing in those transactions. And now they need to add that to the data set as well as part of their operations, right? The person who's receiving it needs to make sure, are these things present? Right? Did we get these things? And so you can do that electronically, right? You could have systems manage that. You could have people manage that or a little bit of both.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So what are the systems that people have been using and you think will be using to exchange that data? We had an interesting conversation last week at the FSMA Tour 4 working group at GS1 about EPCIS.
Yep.
And I, you know, full disclosure, I'm biased heavily in favor of EPCIS because the company that pays my paycheck, Williot Ambient IoT Player, you know, we collect things like temperature data from the tags and humidity data, and we want that to be passed up and down the supply chain. And no way is that going to get passed up and down on a barcode. So we want to see EPCIS. But I have concerns about whether, and I think obviously GS1 wants people to use EPCIS. It's a new standard and that's the business that they're in. And presumably, I assume that you guys, you folks are in favor of it because it's, you know, another reason to use a proper system like the one that you sell to exchange that data. But where do you see we are in the adoption of EPCIS? And I'm just interested in your thoughts about that.
Yeah. So EPCIS, which I think is a, you know, for the listeners to understand, you know, it's a GS1 standard for exchanging data. They have a whole host of transactions that can be exchanged. And this is different than traditional EDI. So if we take a step back, you know, in a lot of our food supply chains, trading partners are using, you know, EDI today to manage certain transactions. But EDI does not manage all of the, there are not EDI data sets for all of the critical tracking events, for example, that have been identified in FSMA 204. And so EDI serves a purpose. And I think that there's companies are going to continue to share information using EDI, because that's how I tell you about what's on the truck and what's coming, et cetera. You know, and I can add additional attributes and send that information. However, once we start talking about, you know, sharing traceability data and those data sets, and it needs to go from system to system and all of that, companies need to think beyond EDI, right? So whatever my role is in the supply chain, shipping is just one little piece of it, right? If I'm a manufacturer, I receive things, I transform things, I ship, I might, you know, do some other activities. So when we get over to EPCIS, number one, it has all sorts of other uses, which we want to get into. But the other piece is when we talk about systems and trading partners, FoodLogic, for example, was part of some pilots that we did with GS1 US with the seafood industry. And so there were a number of solution providers. We had a retailer and then some suppliers. So the solution providers were FoodLogic, IBM Food Trust, RightBio, I think Whole Chain was a part of it. And then the retailer was Walmart. And then the suppliers, we had Beaver Street, Bumblebee, Chicken of the Sea. And so gathering data, right? So for those critical tracking events, the capture of the information about the products that we were exchanging, and then sharing that data along the chain. What we knew was the solution providers all knew that we could use EPCIS to share data. We knew it would work. The part of that pilot that took the longest was the data gathering from the partners, them actually going back in their systems and pulling the data. So we know that as companies are getting ready for this regulation, that's going to take a long time, right, to understand where is all this data sitting in my system. But getting to the data exchange with EPCIS, we recognized, for example, FoodLogic and IBM were making a handshake during the pilot, And one of the things that we kept pointing out as part of our findings was, hey, we're all known entities sharing data, you know, in this pilot. What happens when we're not known entities, right? And I need that information. Number one, how do I know that I need to go to the food trust to get data for this partner, and I need to go to Ripe to get data for this partner? Really? And then the second piece, once I do get to the right door, how do we make that handshake that says, yes, you know, you're approved to share data with, right? So similar to the GDSN, which we don't have a GDSN for traceability, you know, how are we going to do that choreography of data request and data sharing? Yeah.
Cards on the table. I am a believer in the need for this hub or network to do that exchange. I think it's something that we as an industry have to come together to put in place. A little bit like, I mean, think about the credit card networks.
Yes.
You maybe don't like them, but that's the lubricant that has enabled commerce between parties that don't know each other. I can have a credit card that's issued by a bank, and the bank of the retailer can be a completely different bank, but we can do business together and it streamlines everything. And I really think we need something like that to exchange this EPCIS data. And in my opinion, it needs to be something that a lot of the main players have joint ownership in. We can't just hand the keys over to one company that's going to be in the middle. There probably need to be some choices of different networks, and those networks need to be funded by a lot of the players that have a lot to gain from doing all this. So that's my soapbox moment.
Yes.
Have to see whether it's going to happen. But
and I will tell you, just from a historical note, those conversations have been happening since the inception of EPCIS. How about that?
I can believe
yes.
it. And I realize, you know, thank you very much for kind of winding us back and explaining in normal English what we were talking about there. If anyone's interested, then there is a Mr. Beacon interview with Dominic Gennard, who was one of the key people in the definition of EPCIS, him and many other people as part of the GS1 standards work. And we have an interview with him on that, as well as Digital Link and Melanie News, also another GS1 player. So there are a lot of resources there. So let's see. I did want to ask you a few things. Oh, yes. Blockchain. I know I saw that FoodLogic had participated in a blockchain trial. I don't know when that was started. Is it still going, or anything you can share about that? Or?
Yep. No. So we are a cloud-based traceability
yes.
platform. Mm-hmm. We have done, like I said, we've done interoperability pilots
yes.
with some of the blockchains, blockchain partners, et cetera. What's been interesting with blockchain is that, you know, it, you know, companies were at one point interchanging blockchain and traceability. They saw them as one and the same, and they weren't understanding what blockchain actually was, right? And what it
Absolutely.
Enables. So
yes.
now that we've had the evolution, there are great partners out there that use blockchain as their technology for, you know, storing traceability data. However, I will say just, you know, in industry adoption and use, as well as what we've learned about blockchain just as a whole, not in food, but just in as a whole, you know, is blockchain the right technology right now, considering, you know, the amount of energy that you have to generate to even produce the, you know, blocks in the chain, and also speed to market, right? When we talk about the food industry, timing is everything, right? That lettuce, the minute you cut it from the field, it's withering, right? The clock is ticking.
Yeah.
And you need
yeah.
to get it to your trading partners as quickly as possible. And in some of our early work, it's like the blockchains just were not able to handle the volume and the speed at which the data needed to be not only committed to the databases, but then shared with other trading partners. And
yes.
so you can't have that lag, right? Yes. Now, I will say that then brings up the question of data quality. And certainly you can have bad data in a blockchain just as quickly as you can have bad data in the cloud or in your own backend systems. So I think if we exchange the idea of companies certainly can be flexible on the technology that they choose to store their data, but you need to be vigilant about having good, clean, accurate data.
No, I completely agree. And I think blockchain doesn't guarantee interoperability. In actual fact, it creates some challenges. And that's what people want, visibility, interoperability. And obviously, you have to have data integrity, but I think you can have that in other ways as well. And
100%. And I will say, too, I think what we've seen with that interoperability piece and integrations, which are so important with this, is lots and lots of companies, FoodLogic included, offer API capabilities, right? So our entire platform is built on API. You can put things in, take things out. You can do that with products and locations and events and all sorts of things. And so, you know, recognizing that this data is valuable, right? And so if you put your program together in that you're collecting good, clean, accurate data, that you're checking for compliance, right? You're validating that all of the required fields are there, that, you know, if it's a G10, that it's got the right check digit, if it's a code list, right? We've got the right values. That data quality is so important because then you can use the data for all those other, you know, things we've talked about. So, you know, using it outside of that food safety compliance piece and taking it to other teams, right? Finance, marketing, inventory, et cetera, and challenging them and saying, you know, how would you like to use this data, right? Because it is valuable information. We've even had trading partners, as natural disasters have happened, they've looked at their traceability data as part of a larger data set to make decisions on where are we going to ship product, what stores are we reopening, and things like that. I mean, it's really powerful information.
Very powerful. So unfortunately, we've got to wrap up at least this segment. We've got another segment that we already recorded, which I think people will really enjoy. You've spoken with great authority, and I think people will understand why if they listen to the second part of our show. But before I go, I've got to ask you about a certain Netflix documentary called Poison. You know, I think everyone in the food business, it's been on their radar. I assume you've seen it. And if you did, then what did you think of it?
So I have seen it, and I will share a personal story with you. So I have a nephew who unfortunately got E. coli poisoning. When he was 18 months old, ate some hamburger that was not fully cooked. He wound up in the hospital. He had HUS. We have had a kidney transplant and a pancreas transplant. So,
oh my goodness.
The combination of the storyline of the baby in the hospital, I've been there. It's heart-wrenching. And the teenager, so the girl who ate the salad, and then she talked about, you know, how she got so sick. So from that E. coli event, from childhood, my nephew couldn't play sports in high school because he was on dialysis. He had, you know, all sorts of health issues that he had to overcome. And it really, you know, to see the film, you know, people have their opinions. Some people think it's the worst thing in the world. Some think, you know, that they didn't tell the whole story. What I will say is that in that film, we saw two people's stories, and they very accurately told their stories. And yes, I think if people were aware of how many other stories are out there that are literally families waiting for a donor, that's a horrible, horrible place to be. Because you can donate, you and I can donate a kidney, and we still have one, you know, that we can use. But if you need a pancreas, you're waiting for somebody's child to die. And that is a horrible place to be. So I am very much a crusader of food safety. I'm the person at the family event that they get mad when I tell them they have to throw the potato salad away because it's been sitting out too long. So, you know, everyone gets a meat thermometer for Christmas, right? Like, it's just, and people can choose, right? Lots of people, it's a choice every day of, you know, what am I going to eat and how am I going to manage it? But I think that the film definitely, brought to light some of the things that consumers need to be aware of, but also, things that have happened in our supply chain. And so, I'll end with this since we're doing this podcast is, we have made great strides since those things happened in technology, in AIDC, right, in software programs, et cetera. So I see part of this challenge as being on us, right? How do we keep that from happening to another family?
I know. And it was absolutely heartbreaking. I think it is an important movie for people to see. It obviously has an agenda. They're trying to pull on people's heartstrings. But the facts are the facts. And it gives you empathy with the tragedy that impacts people. And you can make your own judgment as to whether they were fair on the companies and the people that are depicted. But I think it's a really important movie. Poison is the name of it, and Netflix is the channel. So, Julie, did you manage to come up with three songs that are meaningful to you?
So I did. So a little known fun fact about me is that I like to sing jazz standards. And so I will do this in bars in Chicago or at your wedding or, family events. So my go-to song that I usually sing anytime I'm singing, it's called Do You Know What It Means to Miss New Orleans? And it's an old song that was sung by, folks like Rosemary Clooney and, Ella Fitzgerald and jazz greats like that. So, so that's a fun fact. Some of my coworkers know that, but now everybody on this podcast knows.
I love that.
Yes.
This is a first for us. I'm super impressed. Super impressed. So is this like, once in a blue moon, or are you out there regularly crooning?
I was regularly crooning before COVID, but then after COVID, we got to get our musicians back on stage. So I have not, I've not done it at a bar, but I have sung at friends' weddings, since COVID. So, yes.
That is awesome. I am now thinking of a good opportunity to ask you to sing at some event just to really shock everyone.
Exactly.
That would be awesome.
Exactly.
All right. Exactly. That's number one.
Well, that's number one. Number two, so my mother was a music teacher, and so she played the piano and other instruments, and she had this songbook. It was called Songs of the 70s, and she played all these songs. So a song that's a favorite of mine is Stevie Wonder's Superstition.
Oh, yes.
Where I first heard that song was my mother playing it on the piano. And then when I heard it on the radio, it's like, what? It's a whole different thing. So, so Superstition's on my, top of the list.
I love that. It's what an incredible musician. I've actually been getting, like many middle-aged people, getting back into vinyl. And so I've been buying old Stevie Wonder vinyl. And it sounds amazing. Sounds amazing. So,
yeah.
Great
and it's
choice.
Amazing, too, to see what influence he's had, how many people sample his music, how many people have re-recorded his songs. There are songs that people think, oh, that's John Legend. It's like, no, that's Stevie Wonder, right? So it's, he's amazing.
Very talented.
Absolutely amazing.
Come on, wait, what's number three?
So number three, I was thinking about this, and a question that I like to ask folks is, what was your first concert, right? So, which is a fun question. And so my first concert where, went with my friends was the Stray Cats. And so the song that I chose was Rock This Town, which anytime I hear that, you know, I can't not get up and dance.
That is, so are they an American band or a British band? They were big in England.
I don't know the answer to that question. I think I would have to look that up. But that whole rockabilly 80s, you know, thing, and they were just, you know, yeah, they hit the scene and it just, you know, it's fun music. So, yeah, so that's my third one.
Awesome. I love that question as well. And my my first concert was Thin Lizzy at the Hammersmith Odeon. Obviously, Phil Lynott's still alive.
Yes.
And he did an amazing job. And I was pretty young. I was in my kind of mid to early teens. And I remember being, you know, London in, that must have been in the 70s, kind of a bit rough. So there were a lot of people with long hair who were thrashing around in the audience, but it was amazing. And
That's a great answer.
Yeah, thank you for triggering that nostalgic feeling in me. So I'd love to hear just a little bit about how you got to the role that you have at the moment. And I was kind of snooping and I didn't realize that you were a veteran of GS1.
Nope.
But before that, it looks like you were, again, and I think you're known for being, you know, an authority in our industry and not shy in coming forward to speak. In fact, I really laughed the other day. We were, I think it was in a FISMA 204 working group meeting, always fun, at GS1. You said, oh, just fit me with a lapel mic. And so I'm assuming that this side of your character started early, if I'm right in saying that you were class president.
It's, yes, and I was class president. So there you go. So my food and beverage career, I started at Coors Brewing Company out in Golden, Colorado, which is a beautiful facility and just a really interesting company. And I worked for them before they merged with Molson, SAB Miller, any of that. So it was still family-owned brewery. And the neat thing was they were self-sufficient. So they did their own malting. They made their own bottles and cans. They had they worked with Ball Corporation and had facilities on campus. I would drive to work every day and you could tell by the smell what point in the brewing process we were at, right? So if it smelled like cereal, right, we were roasting and malting. You could tell when they were brewing and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So all the way through to when they would clean out the tanks and they would mash take the leftovers, mash it into pellets, and then the farmers would pull up and bring their trucks and then take that away for feed for their animals. So it really was a really interesting company to work for. And one of the neat things they did that really helped open my eyes to manufacturing was you had to take a class that was called, you know, Coors 101, and you learned every single job. Like you were on the brewery floor, you were at the plants. You did a ride along with a driver who was delivering product to the stores. You just saw every part of the business. And so it really was interesting to see that. Now, I was in the IT department, so I was working on early days of collecting data from our distribution partners, and a number of retailers were starting their EDI programs. So they wanted to do electronic invoicing.
Yeah.
And things like that. And so they were asking it of all the breweries. And so we didn't care which solution you chose. We just needed you to start sending EDI messages. So Miller, Anheuser-Busch, and Coors were all helping their distributor partners get ready for that. And so that's really where, from that IT side, I moved into, just master data, you know, data gathering. But my boss left Coors to go work for this internet startup called Transora. And Transora was a company that was funded by manufacturers. It was going to be this data hub, if you will. And so they had master data, which we now know as the GDSN. They had coupons. They had logistics. We were doing CPFR. We were going to be everything to everyone. And slowly but surely, you know, things like the GDSN came about. And so we were one of the first data pools, Transora, UCCNet, and others. And then eventually the mergers started. And UCCNet, which was owned by the Uniform Code Council and then eventually GS1US, they purchased Transora. So that now, that data pool is now One World Sync. So if your listeners are familiar with One World Sync.
Oh, so that's like one of the biggest GDSNs. So just for people that don't know, what's a GDSN?
So the GDSN is the Global Data Synchronization Network. And so I started working for Transora in November of 2000. And so at the time, there was this idea of how can we get manufactured data where it's a one-to-many model? And so that manufacturers have one version of the truth, they load all their data into this network, and then trading partners, it's a publish and subscribe model, trading partners can access that data. So I load all my, you know, crackers and cookies and chips and whatever else I make. And then trading partners who are requesting that data can request either data directly from me as a supplier, or if they want to put out a general request and say, I'm looking for chips, cookies, whatever, in the US, like you can really narrow or have a very wide request. And then in this network, there's something called the global registry. And think of that as like the traffic cop who's directing the traffic. So requests come in, and I don't need to know where this data lives. I make a request. I'm looking for chocolate chip cookies. The registry takes a look and says, who has registered chocolate chip cookies? Oh, these 100 companies. They forward that request to those parties. The parties take a look and say, yep, I want to do business with this partner, or no, I don't know who this is. And then once you make that handshake to release data, to share data, the partner receives it. They decide what they want to use and keep. And from that point forward, once you do the handshake that says, yes, I want to synchronize on this item, anytime there's an update, if I lower my sodium, if I change my corrugate, if I rebrand, etc., any and all updates get sent to every single partner that has subscribed to that item. And so the beauty of it, I don't have to remember, oh, I need to send it to Steve, and I need to send it to Bob, and I need to send it to Sue. Nope. You know, the network manages both the connecting partners and continuous synchronization.
And particularly useful if Steve, Bob, and Sue have online stores where you can buy that product.
The changes in how companies use the data is, it's like a hockey stick as far as growth, right? Because where we started was order management systems, mostly things that were behind the scenes. And then companies started adding online ordering platforms. And they had platforms, for example, in food service, right? My restaurants can order from my distribution platform and things like that. And so connecting all this data, synchronizing it, sharing it, et cetera. Now that has moved into images. And when we were doing images, it was old school planograms. If you remember, like the old school Apollo software and things like that. Now, right, everything's got to be 3D. I've got to be able to spin it around and see the nutrition facts panel and the barcode and this and that, and connect to additional information about maybe it's organic or fair trade and all that. So, you know, the data set that we started with and where we are today is like, it's like you're on two different planets.
Well, we're working on this browser for the physical world. It's a mobile app called Living Web. So it's not on the App Store yet, so don't look for it, but hopefully it will be by the end of the year. And the idea is you point the camera at the product, and basically you can get metadata about that product superimposed over the AR image. And so what we're thinking is, well, we could just pull those 360-degree images from one of these GDSN repositories and use that to train the AR. So that's how the app recognizes the product. We'll have to see if it works, but that's the theory. So GDSN is like a GS1 standard for that master data.
Right.
And then you go to different services that make it available in your geography. Is that right?
Right. So there are standards for the attributes themselves. There's a global data dictionary that defines all of the attributes. There is choreography that is required for data pools to share data, and I'll talk about. The data pools are the parties that provide the service. So when we talk about the global data synchronization network, it's kind of like our cell phones. I choose my cell phone provider based on what equipment they offer, right? What phones do they have? What programs do they have? Same thing is true for the GDSN. I choose my GDSN data pool based on the services and the support and the tools that they provide. Once I'm in the network, it's very similar to cell phones. I don't need to know what data pool you're on. What I need to know is tell me what your corporate GLN is. There's something called an IP or an information provider GLN. Once I know what that is, you and I can start connecting on that on the GDSN. And so the neat thing is, just like cell phones, right? What's your number? I can call you. I can text you. I can do different things. But the parties within the network know how to, the data pools know how to talk to each other. They follow certain choreography and they are certified. They go through a certification to be a data pool. And so there's, I can't remember what the number is, but there's I would say probably upwards of 60 data pools around the globe that are managing mm-hmm. this data.
Very good. So you ended up at GS1 through acquisition.
Through acquisition. Yep. Yep. So we were a data pool, and then I worked with a number of accounts. They threw me at the beverage guys because I came from beverage, mm-hmm. so I managed all the sodas and juices and beer and all those different things because I understood the whole direct store DSD model, and so I worked with a lot of them. But I had a lot of CPG companies that I worked with as well. And then once we merged, that's at the time when the food service initiative was just getting started at GS1. And so they asked me to join that team. And I worked on that project until I left GS1 in 2017. So helped stand up the food service initiative, help companies understand how to utilize barcodes. Because if you think about food service back in 2009, they weren't using much identification at all, not even ITF-14s and UPCs. Lots of boxes had nothing on them.
Really?
So helping them understand how to use GS1 identifiers. And then from that, it was using the identifiers, using the GDSN, and now we're working on the traceability piece, which was always part of the vision of that initiative. So GS1 US has a food service initiative and they have a grocery initiative, and those two work hand in hand to help industry understand how to use, identify products, capture data, and then share data.
And how did you end up going from GS1 to Foodlogic IQ?
Right. So, I had reached a point, I'd been at GS1 Transora for over 16 years. And I very much enjoyed, working with lots of different companies, learning lots of different things, right? Because you'd be switching from, beverages to meat to produce, et cetera. And really enjoyed it. But one of the things that I missed was manufacturing. So when I started my job search, if you had asked me back then, I was 100% sure I was going back to manufacturing because I really enjoyed my time at Coors Brewing. And so I started my search. And when I started my search, I was reaching out to all my contacts, and I had reached out to Foodlogic. And so I'm talking to my colleague, Andy Kennedy, who worked with GS1 quite a bit. He was one of the founders of Foodlogic. And so when I reached out to him, we had a conversation. And then the next thing I knew, I was interviewing for a role at Foodlogic. And so I went from helping industry create the standards, and now I work for a company that implements the standards.
Very good. Very good. And did your time at Coors turn you into a beer connoisseur, or was it like too much beer? I never want to see another pint again.
Well, a little bit of both. What was interesting is at the time, you know, all the microbreweries and the micro craze really hadn't started. But at Coors, their master brewers, they at the time were making brown ales, pumpkin ales. That's when they invented. I was there when Blue Moon was introduced. So they had all these beers that people did not understand, right? What is this? And they had a really neat program where they made seasonal beers that they only sold to restaurants in Denver.
Huh.
So they'd make a couple kegs in their microbrewery of, say, a Christmas ale, and then certain restaurants would have that available. And so I learned to love all different kinds of beer working there. But the beer craze, Denver had quite a few breweries before I left. But when I moved to Chicago, there was one microbrewery here, and that was 23 years ago. There was one microbrewery here, and it was Goose Island. Oh. And now there's hundreds of microbreweries in this town, which is really interesting because Chicago was a beer city. Like it had a lot of brewers, and as did our neighbor Milwaukee. So it was interesting to come from that beer culture to a city that hadn't even started. So I actually, you know, there's quite a few. For example, throughout the city, there's, you know, you can go to a bar and get English beers or Scottish. You know, you can get German, etc. So those were the places that I would seek out when I needed my, you know, whatever. I needed a Belhaven or a whatever to satisfy that. But now they're everywhere, right? I could walk to one in my neighborhood.
Very good. Well, I feel like I'd like to pull a pint and sit down and talk with you some more about this, but we've both got to go.
Yes.
So I want to thank you. This has been delightful. Wonderful conversation. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks so much, Steve.
So, thank you very much for listening and maybe watching this episode. You are a remarkable person because most people don't stick to the end. Most people have the attention span of a gnat, something that I battle with myself. And we try and dig deep in these podcasts, and this was a good one, in my opinion at least. I certainly enjoyed it. Julie is a great raconteur and an amazing authority, and you understand why given all the jobs that she has had. So please do stick with us. We've got an incredible archive of interviews with CEOs of many of the startups that are driving innovation, as well as some of the giants, both standards bodies and companies like Cisco and Google. And whilst I work at Williot, we give 100% of the advertising revenue from any of the adverts you've had to put up with to the Monarch School for Homeless Kids, which is an amazing non-profit. So I'm sure they're grateful to you for the pennies that you've contributed. Hopefully we can get enough together that this becomes meaningful. So until next time, thank you, and stay safe.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset.
and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.